This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. At least 50 people were killed, dozens injured in a fire likely caused by an oxygen tank explosion at a coronavirus hospital in Iraq's southern city of Nasiriyah, according to health officials and police. As rescuers combed the smoke-charred building in search of more bodies, the prime minister held urgent meetings with senior ministers and ordered the suspension and arrest of health and civil defense managers in Nasiriyah. The manager of the hospital was also suspended and ordered to be arrested. Already decimated by war and sanctions, Iraq's healthcare system has struggled to cope with the coronavirus crisis, which has killed more than 17,000 people and infected more than 1.4 million. Health officials in Nasiriyah said that search operations at the Al Hussein Coronavirus Hospital were continuing after the fire was brought under control, but thick smoke was making it difficult to enter some of the burnt wards. Large contingents of Cuban police continued patrolling the capital of Havana following rare protests around the island nation against food shortages and high prices amid the coronavirus crisis. Cuba's president says the demonstrations were stirred up on social media by Cuban Americans in the United States. Many young people took part in Sunday protests in Havana, which disrupted traffic until police moved in after several hours and broke up the march when a few protesters threw rocks. Demonstrators and others in communities around the tightly controlled country marked some of the biggest displays of anti-government sentiment in decades. Authorities appear determined to put a stop to it. Again, large contingencies of Cuban police continue to patrol the capital late Monday. This is VOA News. The arrest of a failed Florida businessman and the assassination of Haiti's president has deepened the mystery into an already convoluted plot. The Christian Emmanuel Sanon is a 62-year-old Haitian who expressed his desire to lead his country in a YouTube video, but he is unknown in Haitian police political circles, and those who know him suggest he was duped by whoever masterminded the assassination of Jovenel Moise. The head of Haiti's police on Sunday accused him of working with those who plotted and participated in Moise's killing, but gave no information on the purported masterminds. The death toll in the Miami area condominium collapse has climbed to 94, according to officials Monday, saying that 22 people still remain unaccounted for. The Surfside mayor, Charles Burkett, said officials are stepping up security at the site to ensure the recovery crews can preserve personal items for family members of the victims. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava said a new round of COVID-19 tests have been administered to local officials after a vaccinated Miami-Dade County Commissioner who helped other officials in Surfside announced that he and his chief of staff tested positive for the virus on Sunday. She said all rapid tests have come back negative. The World Health Organization now says rich countries should not be ordering booster shots for their vaccinated populations while other countries have yet to receive initial COVID-19 vaccines. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said deaths were again rising from the COVID-19 pandemic. Delta variant was becoming dominant, and many countries had yet to receive enough vaccine doses to protect their health workers. He added that this behavior is prolonging the agony and is taking the world hostage. He singled out vaccine makers Pfizer and Moderna as companies that were aiming to provide booster shots in countries where there were already high levels of vaccination. Tedros said that they should instead direct their doses to COVAX, the vaccine-sharing program mainly for middle-income and poorer countries. South Korea's streak of more than 1,000 daily coronavirus cases has reached a week as health authorities scramble to slow a viral surge that has brought Seoul's thriving nightlife to a standstill and professional baseball to a halt. Authorities said Tuesday that more than 800 of the 1,150 new cases are in the greater capital area, where officials have shut down nightclubs and prohibited private social gatherings of three or more people after 6 p.m. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July the 13th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. South Africa has deployed security forces to quell violence that erupted in the aftermath of former President Jacob Zuma's jailing.
Their shops have been looted and infrastructure has been destroyed. This means that our sick cannot get medication from pharmacies, food does not reach supermarket shelves, and health workers cannot go to work.
And British Prime Minister condemns online racist attacks targeting black players who missed goals in the Euro 2020 Championship shootout.
I think they are incredibly proud of what they've done. For some of them to be abused is unforgivable, really.
And Gambian lawmakers unanimously passed a law that aims to protect the rights and freedoms of people with disabilities in the West African nation. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. South African security forces have been deployed to quell violence that erupted in the aftermath of former President Jacob Zuma's jailing. Days of violent protest in two provinces have left at least six people dead. Addressing the nation, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa pleaded for calm.
Their shops have been looted and infrastructure has been destroyed. This means that our sick cannot get medication from pharmacies, food does not reach supermarket shelves, and health workers cannot go to work. We will soon be facing a huge risk of food insecurity and medication insecurity in a few weeks. Our vaccination program has been severely disrupted just as it is gaining momentum. Thanks to the work of our law enforcement agencies, 166 suspects have been arrested in KwaZulu-Natal and 323 suspects have been arrested in Gauteng in relation to these incidents.
Pro-Zuma protests broke out when he handed himself to prison authorities last week and quickly escalated into looting and arson, mainly in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. Police said that it had arrested 219 people as a South African court began hearing an appeal launched by Mr. Zuma on his prison sentence. Mr. Zuma's lawyers are asking the court to release him on the grounds that the Constitutional Court improperly imposed the sentence in his absence. For more on this, I reached Eldred de Klerk, a principal associate at the Africa Center for Security and Intelligence in Cape Town. He says that it seems that the security agencies right now are holding back to avoid any confrontation with the rioters for fear that it might turn violent, adding that even though these riots might have started out in protest of Zuma's jailing, they have become a vehicle to air out other economic grievances that have especially been exacerbated by the COVID-19 lockdowns in the country.
Concern right now is that the police are holding back, yeah? That they don't want to engage with unbridled force, and therefore they seem to be not handling the situation like they would normally handle a routine public protest. We've also seen from accounts, and I'm in contact with a network of people who are conflict resolution interveners, monitors, and they are saying that there's also a determined element within this group that will not hesitate to pelt the police with stones, but apparently is also bringing firearms to the party, so to speak.
Are you saying that the currently the police or the security agencies are holding back because they're trying to avoid the Marikana type incident?
Well, absolutely. That's what everybody is saying, and the police minister himself has said so. And I find them to be justified in doing so because they are being met by overwhelming numbers of people.
And what do the rioters want? What are their demands, and how would the government meet those demands without going against the courts?
Let's be clear. This has got nothing to do with the former president, who's looking to rescind his 15-month contempt of court sentence. It may have started off like that. Now we see that people have piggybacked and exploited the opportunity for the call to support the former president, and have now taken to target very specific places. So initially they targeted food outlets and liquor outlets. This following our extension of our level 4 lockdown last night, Sunday night, for another 2 weeks. So that, apparently there was almost a immediate reaction to that. Remember, we're dealing with endemic poverty, high levels of unemployment, a very youthful population, that for whom this has now become an adventure. How to outwit the police? What can I do?
Now, former President Zuma remains popular despite allegations of corruption. Does it appear that he defied the courts because he counted on this type of reaction from his supporters?
Well, I hope not. It would actually betray his legacy if that's in fact what he's done, because he was the first one to, he was one of the leaders to say that we have an unsurpassed constitution, we fought for a constitutional democracy, and we should uphold the values and the essence of our constitutional democracy and respect the independence of the judiciary. That's what he staked his public leadership on. If he now steps away from that, he'll be defeating and actually undermining his own legacy.
Is there any credibility to these allegations that in the past courts have treated these type of cases differently, and that individuals like who have defied court have not actually been jailed, have not gone to jail, they have been subject to home arrest or house arrest?
Not really. The courts have jailed them. And it's what's happened after the judicial process, because then it becomes a political process. Whether that's in the purview of the Minister of Correctional Services to seek early parole, or whether that's in the preserve of the state of the president, state president, to pardon somebody. So it's been a process after the judicial process they found somebody guilty. Then there's been a much more political intervention. To get them early released out on a early health parole and the like.
What is the mood like in Cape Town where you were? Is there tension, some sort of tension? Are people watching this in anticipation that this coming? Are they taking any precautions?
The word you use is anticipation. People are expectant. All it needs, it's a powder keg, I think the country is, and all it needs is a spark. And it doesn't take much. Fortunately, it's been raining,
right.
And there's been flooding. And, you know, Cape Town has large floodlands, and we always contend with flood water. Large wetlands, and we contend with flood water. We're hoping that would help to damper the mood, literally and figuratively. Yet, we can't say what's going to happen later in the week. If this persists beyond tomorrow and the next day, it will definitely come to the rest of the country, including.
Eldred de Klerk is a principal associate at the Africa Center for Security and Intelligence in Cape Town, South Africa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. England's defeat on penalty kicks in the final of the European Soccer Cup caused a barrage of online racist attacks against black players who missed goals in the shootout. Sabina Castofranco reports from Rome.
The Euro 2020 soccer final between Italy and England, played at Wembley Stadium Sunday night, was nerve-wracking for fans of both teams. Italians were very concerned when England scored their goal just 2 minutes into the game. England fans started worrying when Italy drew even in the second half. And on both sides, all fans were anxious about who would win when no team managed to score in extra time and the penalty shootout became inevitable. England was the favourite at the start of the game as it was playing at home in front of tens of thousands of fans, and fans were convinced the team would manage to bring the cup home for the first time. Italians were hoping the cup would return to Rome after 53 years. In the end, Italy won the shootout 3-2 when three of England's black players missed their spot kicks. A barrage of racist attacks on social media followed, which led England's Football Association to release a statement Monday morning condemning the racist abuse of its players. The statement said, "The FA strongly condemns all forms of discrimination and is appalled by the online racism that has been aimed at some of our England players on social media." It added that anyone behind such disgusting behavior is not welcome in following the team. The FA said it would do everything to support the players affected while urging the toughest punishments possible for anyone responsible. England manager Gareth Southgate, who shouldered the responsibility for the team's loss, praised his players and condemned the online slurs.
They should be, and I think they are, incredibly proud of what they've done. For some of them to be abused is unforgivable, really.
The England team has been praised for the high-profile anti-racist stance it has maintained during this Euro Championship and before. Prime Minister Boris Johnson posted his comment on Twitter, saying this England team deserves to be lauded as heroes, not racially abused on social media. He added that those responsible for this appalling abuse should be ashamed of themselves. London police have opened an investigation. Twitter, for its part, said it has taken down more than 1,000 tweets and suspended several accounts used to post racist abuse directed at the England players. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Gambian lawmakers unanimously passed the Persons with Disabilities Bill last week, a law that aims to protect the rights and freedoms of people in the West African nation. Regional Director for Article 19, Fatou Yane Sengo, spoke to Ricky Shryok about how her group has been working with Gambian Federation of People with Disabilities for 2 years to advocate for the law, which they think is an important first step.
It is important because they have been advocating for the law for more than a decade, and they have been promised that a legal framework will be enacted to correct certain inadequacy of the framework. One of the most important achievements, I think, is to have a law that will protect their rights in terms of social welfare, but also instructing public and administration to adapt for the different public services for people with disability. And I think also importantly, the issues around the communication sector, including issues of sign languages and many other important fundamental rights, are taken care into the law. What I believe is important for us as an organization, we believe that all rights are equal. And when you have a system that doesn't take into account the right for special needs, it will be very difficult to achieve human rights for all. It is a big step. We know also that many countries have passed disability bills, but they will not put in place mechanisms. That is why it is very important for Gambia to start working with all the stakeholders to ensure that the law is not in drawers. It's a nice thing to have. We don't want to have a situation where it will be just a nice thing to have so that one can tick boxes. We want this law to be meaningful to the stakeholders.
What kind of things need to be put in place now to ensure that the law actually goes into effect in reality for people who need it?
Yeah, we believe that it will take care of certain aspects, but it's only when proper framework is set up now to give meaning to the law that we will see some result. But at least the law in itself is important, and it gives big achievements.
What kind of challenges face people in Gambia who, for instance, need sign language, who perhaps can't hear, or who face these physical challenges?
Yeah, they don't have sign language across the board, including in the public service. Most of the public events, few are on sign language, and sometimes they only take into account one disability. And also capacity in terms of people who are in the academia to make sure that they have the tools necessary at the university and, subsidizing them for people, you know, who are visually impaired to be able to pursue their education at a certain level. There are few who finish their education. They are still vulnerable. Most of them are begging, which also can be corrected if you have corrective measures.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
It is important, but a law is not enough. We have to have political commitment. And also we need also to see people with disability differently in society. And I think the important thing that we are looking for also beyond the political rights, they need to have proper measures also to uplift their economic status for them also to have equal chances for education, health, etc. During the COVID, we've seen how vulnerable many people with disability, they face a lot of challenges during the COVID-19 because some of them had limited access to public service and also their movements were restricted.
Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, PDP, says that it is unacceptable for the government to come up with new measures to stifle free speech. The party says two new media bills being considered by the governing All Progressive Congress, APC, to regulate media undermines provisions in the Constitution which protect freedom of expression. If the media bill passes, a person found guilty faces up to 3 years in jail. It will also impose a fine of $12,100 against any media house or journalist who is found guilty of violating the measures. The PDP's reaction follows a two-day media blackout campaign carried out by the country's newspaper publications. But responding to concerns of Nigerian journalists and civil society groups about the new media bills, Senator Ajibola Basiru, chairman of the Senate Committee on Media and Publicity, sharply denied accusations that measures will lead to gagging the media and free speech. Supporters of the governing APC said that it is prudent for media professionals to be held accountable for providing wrong information that threatens the country's existence, peace and stability. Kola Ologbondian is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition PDP. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that his party will continue to resist any efforts to stifle free speech, which he says is protected by the Constitution.
The People's Democratic Party has constantly come against the gagging of free speech, whether of individual Nigerians or of media organizations. We have protested the plot by the All Progressive Congress and its federal government, led by President Muhammadu Buhari, to bring up all manner of laws to gag the media space. And we say that all our statute books, particularly our constitution, has provided for means of punishing offenders. And now coming up to bring up amendments and create fresh acts of the parliament that will curtail free speech is totally unacceptable. We have said that clearly and will not stop saying it until all plots are withdrawn.
Some people are suggesting that the lawmakers are right to attempt to ensure that media personnel are truthful and publish the correct, genuine information, not information that will mislead the public and undermine the country's territorial integrity as well as peace and stability. How do you respond to that?
The federal government, I'm sorry to say, is exposing itself as being uneducated. And I say so because there are various platforms in the media space. There are those that you can understand that dwell on rumors. And there are laws in the country that says that if you go against the rule of law, if you go against the rule guiding free speech, you can be tried. There are various laws available. But you do not come up with a wholesome act that is meant to stall the media process. A wholesome law that you want to put into use to gag free speech. That is totally unacceptable.
Kola, the chairman of the Senate committee at the National Assembly, Senator Ajebola Basiru, defended the bills by saying that the fact that one regulates the activities of the media like radio, television, does not mean you are gagging the media. How do you respond to that?
It does. It does. For instance, the People's Democratic, members of the People's Democratic Party are having brought up to speak on radios and televisions because of fears that they will be forcefully reprimanded by the National Broadcasting Commission. Operators in the media space are being fined humongous sums, and they are receiving threats of closure just because they provided avenue to hear the other side of all issues concerning Nigeria. And this is totally, totally unacceptable. You recall that when the People's Democratic Power was in office, we passed the Freedom of Information Bill into an act, and it was signed into law by President Goodluck Jonathan. But what do we have today? The media space is being shortened against the wishes of Nigerians.
Kola Ologbondian is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition, PDP. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. The Restaurant Association of South Africa estimates that over 50% of eateries have gone out of business since COVID-19 lockdown restrictions began 15 months ago. When announcing the extension of the current lockdown a few days ago, President Cyril Ramaphosa gave the industry some relief, but many say the aid is too little too late. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The Restaurant Association's pre-lockdown database of 23,000 restaurants now stands at just 11,000. It's been inundated with messages and calls from desperate owners and workers. Many are depressed and suicidal. One of those who had to close after over 30 years is the owner of Founders Restaurant in Johannesburg, Michael Evlambio. He says he's lost his life savings and insurance would not help, saying he wasn't covered for the pandemic.
Thank goodness I have my two children, and as a single father, I can't even entertain those thoughts. But it is very hard. You get home at night and you do feel useless and you feel hopeless. And you wake up in the morning and you just got to try and find a way of bouncing back. I believe as restaurateurs, we are resourceful and we are innovative, but there just comes a time where you just feel that every door gets closed on you.
He had to lay off 40 staff members, and while government is making some special payments to permanent restaurant staff and other workers affected by lockdown restrictions, those who work part-time, like waiters, are not covered.
It's heartbreaking when your staff members are coming to you and saying, you know, we need money for transport, we need money for this, we need money for that, and you just can't give any more. And it's gut-wrenching because they become family. You know, restaurateurs, we are passionate people. We love our industry. We love our staff. We do it for the love of, you know, to me, the best thing about a restaurant is seeing a restaurant full and with happy places. It's a place for a person to come and enjoy themselves. And at the moment, we're sitting now fighting for 10% of our turnover, still putting in 70 hours a week.
The South African Restaurant Association's president, Wendy Albert, says President Ramaphosa's announcement that restaurants can move from selling just takeaway meals, as they have been for the past 2 weeks, to 50 sit-down patrons at a time, depending on the size of the venue, is not enough. She says besides capacity, two of the major problems are the continued ban on the sale of alcohol and the 9 p.m. curfew, which kills dinner time trade.
You know, whilst we appreciate that President Ramaphosa certainly has heard the pleas and cries of the restaurant industry, we just don't feel that they've completely understood what we need. You know, as we look at the decisions that have been made, we can't comprehend who is actually representing the restaurant industry. You know, we are not food trailers. We are sophisticated businesses with overheads, and we simply cannot pay our bills on the limited seating capacity that has been awarded to us.
Albert says they want representation and they want scientific evidence from government that shows that restaurants are more risky than shopping malls.
We need to gain confidence in government. We need to open up the lines of communication, have a collaborative relationship. We need support on the debt and the bank loans and the deferment on that, as well as the VAT deferment. We also need landlords to be supportive.
She's also calling on the vaccination of restaurant workers to be prioritized. South Africa is in the grip of a third wave that is being driven by the fast-spreading Delta variant. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of American News in Cape Town.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July the 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English for Africa service. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very